I'm Andy Bates, part of the team here at KFUO. While you hear me on the air and in podcasts, I'm also part of the team that works behind the scenes to bring you the programs like this that you value. What you hear on the air and in podcasts is just the tip of the iceberg. Listeners like you generously support everything that makes radio and podcasts happen. Administration, cutting-edge technology, software, hosts, producers, and more. You make this happen. Can we count on you to continue this support? KFUO Share-a-thon, now through April 5th, is a great time to show your support and make a gift or make a plan to give for a whole year. Your generosity is important and appreciated, not just by the KFUO team, but by listeners who get to hear and enjoy Christ-centered programs every day. Will you make a gift today? KFUO.org/give. KFUO.org/give.
Welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on Worldwide KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in Faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Tuesday, April 1st, we're studying 2 Samuel chapter 6, verses 1 to 23. In today's text, David brings the Ark of the Lord to the city of Jerusalem. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us returning guest, Pastor Bart Day. Pastor Day serves as the president and CEO of Lutheran Church Extension Fund in St. Louis, Missouri. Pastor Day, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Thank you, Pastor Apple. It's always great to be with you.
It is a joy to have you with us today. As we get started looking at 2 Samuel 6, remind us of the context, not only from the book of 2 Samuel, but also looking back a little bit farther. It's been a while since we've heard about the Ark of the Lord.
Yeah, that's right. So in the context here today, of course, you've already studied now 2 Samuel 5, where David is anointed the king, and he's going to be king over Judah and Jerusalem. He conquers the Jebusites, so he now has conquered Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is now going to become the city. It will become David's city. And if you're going to have a king and you're going to have a city, then of course you need the ark. And so that's what we'll talk about today in 2 Samuel 6, David bringing the ark into holy city Jerusalem. But as you said, we've not heard about the ark for a while, and that would have your listeners go back to 1 Samuel chapters 4, 5, 6, and the first part of 7, where the ark is sort of used like a weapon of war, maybe kind of inappropriately, where the Philistines are fighting the Israelites, and the Israelites bring out the ark, kind of like a holy hand grenade, right? You bring this thing out, surely it'll kill everyone. And it doesn't work out that way. The Philistines actually take the ark, and the Israelites are rather shocked. And then, of course, the ark becomes, again, the seat of God, and that causes an awful lot of distress and hurt and harm to the Philistines. And you have the whole, they drag it in Dagon's temple, and Dagon is falling over, and his hands are breaking off, and obviously, he's in the presence of the living God, and so the Philistines do everything they can in 1 Samuel 6 to get the ark back to the Israelites, to hand it back to them. There's a long story there of everything that happens, which people should go back and read, but at the very first part of chapter 7 in 1 Samuel, the men of Kiriath Jearim came, and they took up the ark of the Lord, and they took it to Abinadab's house on the hill, and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to guard the ark of the Lord. And so now, today, where we're at in 2 Samuel 6, the ark has been there in the house of Abinadab for 20 years, and now David is going to go with his men to bring the ark, to put it in the city of the king, Jerusalem.
So with that context of the Ark having been in Kiriath Jearim and now being brought to the city of Jerusalem, which David has recently conquered and made his capital, and thinking about the way that the Israelites misused the Ark previously in 1 Samuel, just remind us of what the Ark is supposed to be. This it's really just a small box. It's got, you know, angels on top of it. But what is the Ark supposed to be for Israel?
Yeah, the Ark is the footstool of God on earth, but it is the place of mercy and forgiveness and atonement. This is the place where God dwells so that he can be among his people to bring them forgiveness of sins and life and salvation. So the Ark for them is to be a blessing, God's presence, his holiness, dwelling with his people on earth. Now, what you had in 1 Samuel, and what we're going to have to talk about today, is that the blessing can become a curse, and God's holiness, his presence, has to be shielded from sinners and sinful people, lest the holiness of God consume them. And so that's going to kind of lead us into today. But yeah, the Ark is this place for mercy where the high priest once a year on the Day of Atonement on Yom Kippur is taking the blood from the sacrifice and bringing it into the Holy of Holies, sprinkling that blood on the Ark, while some of the other blood has been placed on the scapegoat, quite literally, and sent off into the wilderness so that people's sins are forgiven and they are atoned for. So we want to always see the Ark as this place of grace and mercy and presence of God. But with that comes order and roles and responsibilities. And again, when unholy things come in contact with the holy, when sinful things come into the presence of holiness, it doesn't always go well for the sinner.
Yeah, that's right. And in that regard, the book of Leviticus is a helpful context for what we're going to read today, because the book of Leviticus, you know, records how God brings his holiness to sinners in a way that doesn't kill them, but in a way that blesses them. And the Ark is a big part of that. But when sinners try to approach the holiness of God apart from the means that he has appointed, it does not go well for them. And we're going to see both of those realities within this chapter. So let's start reading here in 2 Samuel chapter 6. This is the first verse and following. David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned upon the cherubim. And they carried the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were driving the new cart with the Ark of God, and Ahio went before the Ark. And David and all the house of Israel were making merry before the Lord, with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. And when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah put out his hand to the Ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God struck him down there because of his error, and he died beside the Ark of God. And David was angry because the Lord had burst forth against Uzzah, and that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the Ark of the Lord come to me?" So David was not willing to take the Ark of the Lord into the city of David. But David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. And the Ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. And that takes us through verse 11. We'll pause there. And so, Pastor Day, as the text starts, David makes preparation to bring the Ark of God, the Ark of the Covenant, described there a little bit, you know, to his holy city. Take us into some of those preparations in the beginning of this journey.
Yeah, so it seems that he brings warriors, maybe even more than just fighting men, right? There's 30,000, so a large crowd wants to protect himself. I do think it's helpful just to remind people, because you have Baal Judah, and we talk about Kiriath Jearim. In the book of Joshua, those names are interchangeable, so I do think we're I do think we're talking about the same place. You know, why David brings the ark is always an interesting question. He has certainly really, really good intentions, but really, really bad execution. As we said, the footstool of God is here. The Lord of hosts, the angels, as you said, you have these cherubim above sitting on top of the ark, God's footstool on earth. And right away it says that they carried the ark on a new cart. And that's not the way you carry the ark. Numbers chapter 4 is very clear about the fact that the ark had these bronze rings on it, and then they put the poles, the Levites would put the poles through there and then carry it. So again, you have good intentions, bad execution right at the start, that the way they're going to move it and handle it to bring it now into the holy city, Jerusalem.
Given the way, and I don't want to steal too much thunder from the next chapter, but at the beginning of chapter 7, David is going to be reflecting on the reality that God dwells in the tent while he himself is dwelling in his house. I do wonder, and I don't want to read too much into David here, but you know, he's got his capital city. And I think David has shown himself to be faithful in the sense that he realizes that he's the prince of God's people and the Lord, Yahweh, is king. And so I wonder, I mean, hopefully this isn't too positive of a reading, but I wonder if David is kind of thinking, well, yeah, I'm the prince among God's people, but the Lord is really the king. And so if this is going to be the capital city, I don't need to be there by myself, but the Lord needs to be there. And so, well, let's move the ark there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's true. It is interesting that, again, we read this where he creates a tent for it, but it's not the actual tent of meeting and all of the furnishings that went along with that. We get that later. The chronicler tells us that it's not until Solomon dedicates the temple that he goes back to get the tent of meeting and all the other attendant pieces of furniture besides the ark that were part of the tabernacle in those days. So it is interesting that he sets up a new tent. But I don't think you're stretching too far. I don't think David has any ill will or malicious intent at all. I think this is now God's holy city. The Jebusites have been taken out. And if you're going to be a man after God's own heart and he's going to dwell in his place, then the thing that you bring, the presence of God, is to bring the ark itself there. Again, I think very good intentions. Yeah. Obviously some bad execution, not only on the part of David of putting a new cart together to do this, but you would also sort of think that Uzzah and Ahio, who've been around their dad for 20 years taking care of the ark, might have known a little bit better about how the thing was supposed to be handled, but...
Yeah, that's right. I think the text itself indicates maybe they're all a little bit naive in this regard, or they just haven't thought this through as well as they should have. When the author says in verse 2, he says the ark of God, and then he describes who God is. He's the one that's called by the name of the Lord of hosts, and yeah, he sits enthroned here. Maybe a little bit from the author there to say, yeah, they moved this. This was probably a good idea, good intentions, but they didn't realize exactly what they were doing when they moved the warrior Yahweh who sits right there on his throne.
Right. And we're going to, again, I don't want to steal thunder from the next part that we're going to read, but when David finally does decide to move the ark and get it to Jerusalem, while we don't really have very much in 2 Samuel about that, we only get a few verses. Like 1 Chronicles chapter 15 goes into like painstaking detail. I mean, and they obviously decided to go back and talk to the Levites and actually do it exactly the right way, the way the thing is supposed to be moved, the way God had told them back in Exodus to move this thing when it was being transported. So a lot of good stuff there and a lot of other places where you can read about this narrative too. But there are other great things here. I know you want to probably keep moving on, but in verse 5 and following, you know, where there is this sort of really unrestrained worship where David and all the house of Israel, they're celebrating because God is actually present and they're bringing it back to Holy City, Jerusalem. And they've got a couple of stringed instruments and a couple of percussion instruments. It's obviously a big celebration, this procession. But of course,
that's when everything goes wrong. So,
yeah, exactly.
So talk to us. I mean, this is kind of the main event, right? It suddenly the scene transitions from unbridled joy and celebration to all of a sudden, the way the text reads, one of the oxen stumbles, Uzzah puts out his hand on the ark and takes hold of it, and at that moment, the Lord's anger is kindled, and he strikes Uzzah down because of his error, which is, I know I've been asked this question many times, and I've pondered it myself, you know, boy, that seems awfully harsh for just a steadied of, you know, it was going to fall, maybe, and Uzzah was just trying his best, so
right.
Talk to us about this, what maybe looks like an overreaction.
Well, I do think Uzzah is trying his best. He's trying to be helpful. He's trying to protect the ark. He's trying to stabilize the ark. If the ox stumbles, he doesn't want the thing to fall. I think it's important to note that this is like the third time where the mishandling of the ark has had really poor consequences. Not only we mentioned Dagon earlier, you know, just like a chapter later there in 1 Samuel, a bunch of people, like 70 people, went to look inside the ark, and they all died.
Yeah.
So the ark is not to be, the holiness of God is kind of not to be mishandled. So Uzzah does what I think any of us would do. But with the holiness of God, it's not a little thing. And so I think it's important to say that, and this is just me, I don't believe Uzzah was eternally condemned for what he did. He simply died. And we die in all kinds of ways, maybe even at the hand of God, but that's not a statement about his sort of eternal condemnation. I don't think Uzzah was punished eternally for what he did. He simply reached out and touched the ark of God's holiness, and in his sinful nature, he simply could not survive, and he's not the first one. So it didn't just happen in Raiders of the Lost Ark. This thing actually, it actually happens in the pages of the Old Testament, again, where the holiness of God is being revealed, and it's full on, and he's there enthroned between the cherubim, and these things do happen.
So, okay, and I think that's a helpful thing to consider. So what happens to Uzzah and what Uzzah does here, maybe it's not, we shouldn't think of it on the same level in terms of the sin that was committed, say, by Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus chapter 10, where they offer unauthorized fire, and then fire comes and consumes them, or like Korah's rebellion in the book of Numbers.
Yeah.
Or,
and the earth
or even
swallows
maybe,
them all up, yeah.
Sure, or the sin of Ananias and Sapphira in the book of Acts, where those are intentionally done sins with, you know, premeditation and done in direct contradiction to a command of God. This one does contradict what God has said, but as maybe a sin of weakness or a sin of stumbling, we shouldn't understand as a lack of faith. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a lack of faith. I don't believe at all. Some of those other examples you gave are truly unfaithful, unbelieving people usurping the authority of God. You think about Korah and the rebellion and what was going on. There is nothing of that with Uzzah. I mean, he's been helping his father and brother take care of the ark for 20 years. He simply does something trying to be helpful. And this is why I think it's interesting where David then becomes so angry, it says. But, Pastor, I really wonder how much of this is guilt from David that, I mean, here is this grandiose moment for the king coming in Jerusalem, and this is now a loss for the king. David appears to be afraid, and he's frustrated. And maybe he's frustrated with Uzzah why he didn't know, but I think he also has to be frustrated. So this seems to be kind of a watershed moment for David, as all of the celebration and procession and everything is going so great and wonderful. And now to have this happen and sort of stop the whole thing, because now the whole community is at risk, right? This is like all of Israel, and one person has died, but who else? And so this awe and respect and fear for God can and is a very good thing. And I think for David, and this is why now he's not willing to take the Ark of the Lord into the city, he becomes quite afraid and fearful, I think, for himself and for all of Israel. I think this causes a great amount of contemplation for David, who is angry, and right, he calls it Perez Uzzah. So the outburst against Uzzah, that will ever know this place where God his anger burst forth. But for David, I think that there's anger, but I think that there's guilt and fear and frustration because of him maybe understanding the magnitude of the role that he has and who God is and his relationship to God too.
Yeah, it's striking that in verses 8 and 9, sorry, in consecutive verses, you get two emotions of David. The scriptures don't always give us the emotions of the people, mm-hmm. but here you find out first he's angry. It doesn't say who he is angry toward, but it does say why he is angry. It's because the Lord burst forth. And then in the very next verse, he now is afraid, and this time it does say who he's afraid of. He's afraid of the Lord. And I think that, like, from anger to fear, I probably would have a similar path of emotions myself.
Yeah, and I think that his fear is a good thing. It's a good thing for him to know who God is and who he is and who he isn't. David's known to be full of himself from time to time, sure, like all of us are. So yeah, there's just this whole bit of emotion. Of course, what's interesting here is that so they take it to the house of Obed-Edom, going to assume that he's a Levite, and it stays there for 3 months. So it doesn't just take it for a day or two. I mean, he's obviously pondering this for a little while. And I think, again, you know, is this kind of a test by David? Like, hey, I'm going to stick it in this holy guy's house, and we'll see how it goes. Like, maybe somebody else is going to die. Like, if he and his whole family, you know, get smitten by the Lord, then maybe we got a bigger problem here. But again, the ark, for what it is now, Obed-Edom and all of his household is blessed. And Samuel doesn't tell us exactly how they're blessed, but I would encourage your folks, again, if you go in 1 Chronicles and you read this narrative, 1 Chronicles says that Obed-Edom's household was blessed and that he had 62 descendants, which I think in that list of the number of descendants is a whole lot more than anyone else. So it seems that, you know, being fruitful and multiplying may have been a great blessing that actually came. And that may be important because at the end of our story, we're going to have not fruitful and not multiplying as a result of the issue that's going to happen between David and his wife.
Oh, yeah, that's a helpful contrast to bring up from 1 Chronicles in that detail. I want to go back briefly to David's fear in verse 9. He was afraid of the Lord. And you said that I think this is a good thing. You know, as Lutherans particularly, we're familiar with the fear of the Lord from the Catechism. We should fear and love God. And we, you know, as pastors, we teach this in confirmation and we reflect upon this reality throughout our lives. And so often we talk about the fear of the Lord as an awe, a respect for the Lord. Right. I think you see here, though, another aspect of the fear of the Lord. And tell us why this kind of fear of the Lord is healthy for us as well.
Well, I would say it's helpful because wherever God is present, he is meant to bless. But God's presence is never neutral. And that means that the blessing, if not received in faith, becomes to us a curse. And so baptism, a gift from God that faith receives, if faith is no longer receiving the gifts and benefits of baptism, it becomes like a curse to us. Same way with the Lord's Supper. There were people who were eating and drinking and not recognizing, Paul tells us, and they were eating and drinking judgment upon themselves. So faith was missing in the component, the ability to receive these gifts. So I think it's healthy because God's presence is, it's never neutral. It never just doesn't do anything. It's always doing something, and it's always meant for blessing. But when not received by faith, it becomes a curse, and that has real consequences to us. And so a healthy dose of fear, not only of awe and respect, but understanding who God is and who we're not, and that he will come again to judge the living and the dead, and he will see us as we are in Christ, but that begs for the gift of faith and mercy from God that we're covered by Christ and that he not see us as we truly are. And so I think that's just helpful for us as Christians in our sanctified life and the third use of the law to still not become complacent of who we are and who God is.
So, I mean, when just then to take that and go back to Uzzah for a moment, then you use the word complacency. Do you think that's what's happened with Uzzah there? Again, not a loss of faith, but just a complacency, not remembering for that moment that he's actually in the presence of the holy God and the full ramifications of it. Like complacency, is that one of the things that we should be on guard against because of a text like this?
Yeah, I think so. I think that that's a good one. Watch, be on guard. You don't know the hour when the Lord Jesus will will return. So, excuse me.
Yeah.
Do not become complacent. Don't be like the virgins and run out of oil. So,
Yeah. Make
sure that you're always prepared. And maybe complacency and just lack of preparation is what caused Uzzah's death. Again, I don't believe his condemnation eternally,
sure.
But certainly his physical death.
Yeah. All right. So at this point then in the narrative, David has left the ark for the time being in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. As you said, perhaps as a bit of a test, what's going to happen after this Perez Uzzah, the Lord has broken out? What will the Lord do to Obed-Edom and his house for the 3 months that the ark is there? The Lord blesses him. You noted from 1 Chronicles that the blessing includes the gift of a lot of children, a lot of descendants. And so from there, David's going to hear this news, and he's going to continue his movement of the ark. We're going to pick that part of the text up on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking about 2 Samuel chapter 6 with Pastor Bart Day this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Did you know that an investment with Lutheran Church Extension Fund exclusively supports LCMS ministries and church workers? That's right. LCEF ensures LCMS churches, schools, and organizations have access to the financial resources they need to sustain, strengthen, and start ministry work. In other words, you can feel good investing with LCEF because we share your Lutheran values and love for the church. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCEF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCEF investments are not FDIC-insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCEF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCEF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Tuesday, April 1st. We're studying 2 Samuel chapter 6, verses 1 to 23 with Pastor Bart Day. He serves as president and CEO of Lutheran Church Extension Fund in St. Louis, Missouri. Pastor, prior to the break, we'd read and discussed through verse 11. The ark has been left at the house of Obed-Edom for 3 months, and the Lord has blessed that house. Now David hears the news and continues the trip to Jerusalem with the ark. So we pick up the text again at verse 12. And it was told King David, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God." So David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. And when those who bore the ark of the Lord had gone 6 steps, he sacrificed an ox and a fattened animal. And David danced before the Lord with all his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the horn. As the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. And they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in its place, inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And when David had finished offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts, and distributed among all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both men and women, a cake of bread, a portion of meat, and a cake of raisins to each one. Then all the people departed, each to his house. And David returned to bless his household. But Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself. And David said to Michael, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, and I will make merry before the Lord. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes. But by the female servants of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor." And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. That is the end of the chapter that we're looking at today, 2 Samuel chapter 6. All right, so Pastor Dave, that section starts in verse 12, where David hears the news about Obed-Edom, and now the journey is going to start again after a three-month delay. Take us into that beginning of the journey.
Yeah, so as we said, if the chronicler is, you know, giving us an insight, they're certainly they were blessed with this multitude, all that belonged to him. He has all of these descendants. And so David is now ready to bring up the Ark of God. In 1 Chronicles 15, and that's where I'd encourage readers, listeners, to go back and read again, we get an awful lot of detail about how David decides to move the ark this time, and again, much more in the fashion of how Moses in Exodus is told to actually transport the ark. Now, one of the things I kind of would like for us to ponder here, since you've read the whole section, is there is something really interesting here about David, in that David, as king, does an awful lot of priestly type activities. Now, not that he's a full-on priest, not that he's doing all the things, but he's certainly doing some of the things. So, I mean, it talks about him offering sacrifice. It talks about him wearing a linen ephod, which is priestly attire. Toward the end then, there's again burnt offerings and peace offerings. It seems that David performed those. He blesses the people. He distributes the sacrificial remainders, right, among the people. I think this is interesting, and I'm not completely sure what to make of it, but I would raise the question of whether or not David is in some ways seen to be a priest in the order of Melchizedek. Mm. Now, Melchizedek, we all know that stuff from Genesis 14, right? And this appearing of Melchizedek, which is often very directly related to Jesus, right? This comes up in Hebrews 7. But even in like Psalm 110, which is one that we know, this talks about, you know, you're a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So is David in some ways, as a prefiguring of Christ, is he given some of these priestly things to do? Is that what we're seeing here? Now, Hebrews certainly compares and contrasts sort of the priestly order of Melchizedek to Christ, right, who is far, far greater, that this is the ultimate priesthood. But I do think, Pastor Apple, it is interesting that David does several kind of priestly things here, which I guess is not out of place when we're moving the ark and bringing it to Holy City, Jerusalem, and having God be present. But it is interesting. And so he takes it from the house. The Levites, we're told, are carrying it. They go six steps, and then they have to take a break. Now, I always find that interesting because I wonder if this is, you know, 6 days of God actually creating, and then on the seventh day we rest. So is this like a little mini Sabbath rest? We go six steps, and now the chronicler tells us it's seven bulls and seven rams, this sort of idea of completeness. And David is dancing or whirling. This is a hapax legomena, so it's the only time the word's used in the Old Testament. I think we always struggle with dancing, right? Like, come on, we're sure. Lutheran. We don't.
What does that? Yeah, what does that actually mean?
Yeah. Well, we as Lutherans don't like dance, or we oftentimes don't think about dancing and worship. And there's plenty of other Christian traditions that do. But that David, you know, in the early verses, there's this sort of unrestrained worship with all the people who are making music and are some of the Levitical musicians there as part of this procession before Uzzah dies. And now this kind of whirling. He's before the Lord, and he's dancing with all of his might, and he's wearing the linen ephod. It doesn't say that that's all he was wearing, but certainly his wife is going to make some assumptions that maybe that was all he was wearing. And of course, she wasn't there. That raises another interesting question, like, why was she not there in the procession? There were obviously other women who were there. But David now is whirling and dancing. They're carrying it the proper way. They're stopping. They have the sacrifices. And now all of the house of Israel brings us up with shouting and the sound of the horn, which gives us sort of images of like Psalm 47. You know, it's going to go up with a shout and with the sound of the horn. That David is doing all of these things, rejoicing as God is bringing his presence now into holy city Jerusalem, having come out of the house of Obed-Edom for 3 months.
Yeah, to the priestly actions of David in this text, or at least echoes of priestly actions, I remember in the book of Exodus where the Lord calls his nation, Israel, a kingdom of priests, and the church then in the New Testament is called the royal priesthood, such that, you know, the priesthood, there is a sense in which all of God's people have a priestly role. But I think what you're saying about David being a, you know, he's the father of the Christ, right? David, and you've got the Son of David, capital S, Son of David. I think this is one of those instances where it's more than just this is a part of the kingdom of priests, but David is a prefigurement of Christ in a number of ways, serving as not only king, but also priest in this regard. I think we are seeing a picture of that, particularly, and not to, we may come back to some of these other parts, but particularly then in the way that he blesses the people and he feeds the people. Like that matter of not only blessing the people, but then feeding the people in this great procession, that in my mind definitely shows forward to the way that Christ acts in his earthly ministry, that he not only is a, you know, one who teaches and speaks to the people, but he eats with people and he feeds the people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Not only point ahead, but if I'm onto anything, and some of our Old Testament profs in the seminaries can tell me if I'm crazy about, it could be pointing back to Melchizedek, right? He's blessing and he's giving out bread and wine. Now we have something different. And in fact, the Hebrew is a little bit odd here of exactly what these cakes of meat and raisins and what all of this was exactly that David gave to them. But you're right. Is David in some ways prophet, priest, and king? And I agree, it's not just the generic priesthood that we all receive as the priesthood, the baptized. David seems to be given some things to do, but rightly given, unlike Korah, which you mentioned earlier, right? Like, we're all priests, we'll all do whatever we want to do, kind of, and the earth opens up and there they go. So David has this special place, and he is doing certainly priestly things, although not all of them.
Sure. Well,
as a prefigurement to Christ.
The contrast with the priestly things, even in contrast to David's immediate predecessor, Saul, one of the big things that Saul did wrong was he offered an unauthorized sacrifice in 1 Samuel chapter 13. Samuel had said, "You wait for me." Saul gets impatient and offers it ahead of time, and that's part of the reason the Lord rejects him as king. That's not a reason for the Lord to reject David as king. And I think, again, it is because of this line of the Christ that's pointing forward, the priesthood of Melchizedek. That's why what David does in this text is good and right and acceptable in the Lord's sight. Whereas for Saul to do it, it was not something he had been authorized or given.
Right. So Saul's daughter, I think picking up on this part.
Sure.
Michal, however we're going to pronounce her name. I mean, this is David's wife, but this is Saul's daughter, right? And there's a whole kind of salty story about even how that ends up happening, right? Like,
sure.
Saul really wants to kill him. And hey, why don't you marry my first daughter here? You know, she's wonderful. And David is very bashful, or like, who am I, right, to become the son-in-law of Saul? And so, well, hey, then I got a second daughter, so here's Michal, maybe you can take her. But it's all, for Saul, it's all a ploy to get David killed, right? But Michal, we're told, loved him, even though, remember, the whole scheme to get David killed was that Saul says, if you want to take her as your wife, you need to go kill me 100 Philistines and bring me back their foreskins. And if that doesn't sound ridiculous enough, David actually thinks this is kind of a great adventure, right? So he goes off and kills 200 Philistines and brings back 200 foreskins so that he can actually have her. But I just say that because even in that context, there's all this jaded history with her too, right? She helps him escape from Saul, and then it talks about her putting the idols on her bed and covering them up. So all of sort of the shadiness of Saul and the lack of faith of Saul is seen in Michal, his daughter. And I don't know that we should be surprised now that she's not there. She's not present. She sees David, and very clearly the text says, in her heart, she despises him. And the chronicler says the exact same thing. So I think the question is, why does she despise David? What is at the root of that hatred that she has for him or despising him that then plays itself out in the rest of this narrative?
Sure, and I think that that's an important thing to consider so that we don't get the wrong impression. You've mentioned the history between David and Michal, how it's kind of gone back and forth, and even more recently than that, you know, when David was on the run from Saul, at some point Michal was taken and given to another husband.
Another man,
and it's only been back in 2 Samuel chapter 3 where part of the, I guess, the conditions for Abner's surrender, if you want to think about it like that, or coming over to the side of David, was you bring Michal back to me. So, I mean, just from that human perspective, I suppose you could understand why the relationship is a bit rocky.
Yeah.
But well, I think there's more going on here when it comes to it's a pretty strong way that the text refers to Dave or Michael's feelings here.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we get to that, maybe we should just kind of, because we'll get to that piece, but so he does bring the ark. This is in verse 17. So she despises him, but it still says he brings in the ark, puts it in a place inside a tent that David had pitched. Again, just for your listeners to remember, this is not the tabernacle, the other tent, which Solomon will go back to, I believe it's in Gibeon. First Chronicles 16 talks about at the dedication, Solomon of the temple, he brings the tabernacle and all of its furnishings back. But then David does priestly stuff, the burnt offerings. He blesses the people. He distributes the food. And then everyone departs, each to their own house. So there is this communal event, as there was at the time of Uzzah. But now the people are being rallied and brought together. But David is blessed to return to his own household to care for them. But as soon as he returns to the household, Michal is berating him. And she comes out of the house to actually confront him. And she believes that what he has done, I think, is selfish, right? He's honored only himself. Like, he's been at the front. He's the one up there ecstatically dancing and whirling around, and it's been about himself. And not only that, but she really insinuates that he's like disrobed himself. Now it says he's wearing the linen ephod, but she insinuates it like that he's naked. And this gives us kind of the idea of Adam and Eve, right? That this is somehow like shameful. So you uncovered yourselves, you exposed yourself before the eyes of all of these female servants who were there. And as one of the vulgar fellows, shamelessly uncovers himself, which, and I don't know how else to say this other than it's almost as if she is saying that David has some kind of immoral sexual urges toward these girls, and this is why he's uncovered himself and why he's danced around the way that he has in this linen ephod. So this is, I mean, she is taking him to task. She is not pleased at all. And again, whether it's just this circumstance or the whole entire jaded relationship that the two of those have and all of these things that have occurred from how they married to what you mentioned just a few chapters before, have her going off and now her being brought back, she is certainly she is certainly unhappy with him and does not believe that he is acting as befitting a king. She wants a king who is powerful and in charge and in control, and he is acting like some weakling or bowing the knee or whatever. He is certainly not the king that she wants or expects, or the husband that she wants or expects. And of course, David's pretty flippant and he doesn't care. I mean,
talk to us about David's response, because it does, like, if she comes and confronts him, he comes right back at her with the same attitude.
Well, yeah, he basically says he would humiliate himself even more if it meant honor to the Lord. And he believes that what he was doing was actually honoring the Lord and showing fitting and proper praise and adoration and fear and awe and all of those things to the Lord, who is present, who has made him king, who's given him victory over the Jebusites, allowing them to come into holy city Jerusalem. He is the one who's present on the ark. He's the one who blessed the house of Obed-Edom. He's now blessed David's house. So yeah, David is, he's not going to have any part of this. And what's even sort of more condemning on the part of David is the way that he responds to her. And it's not just about her. David makes it about Saul and about his entire household and his lineage. So it was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all of his house. So this is really a rejection of her, and even more so a rejection of Saul for who he was, or maybe better yet, who he wasn't. And so I'm going to celebrate before the Lord. What I'm doing is not selfish, and I would do it even more so if this brings fitting honor to the Lord.
I do think that David's mention of Saul in this context is a part of the reason that this is included in the text at all. That this is, I mean, we've seen recently with the civil war in Israel how Ishbosheth died, and we heard that the only really other descendant of Saul that's out there at this point is Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan. He'll come up again later in 2 Samuel. But there still is this, if you're thinking about in terms of like kingly lines, there is still this unresolved thread from a human perspective. Well, David is married to Saul's daughter, and so could that create confusion down the road as to, you know, who the real king is, where the line is really going? And I think that's part of the reason that this is included as a part of the narrative with this little story, as strange as it may seem. You see, no, the Lord is going to continue his line through David, and Saul's house is not going to have a part of it. David may be kind to Saul's house in the future when it comes to Mephibosheth, but the line of kings, and as we're going to see in the very next chapter, the line of the Christ is not going through Saul, it's going through David.
Absolutely, and probably to drive that point home even more, the last verse in 23... And Michael, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. And I think you have to ask, you know, what does this mean? And more so, why? Why did she not have any children? And, you know, people are divided on this, and you sort of have people in two different camps. But I don't think that they're, like, mutually exclusive of each other. In fact, there's probably a thread between them. I mean, you have a group of people who say that this happens as a result of David rejecting her. That basically after this encounter, their relationship comes to an end, meaning there are no more marital sexual relations between David and his wife, and therefore there's no children. The other side is a number of people who believe that this is a curse from God because of her disobedience. As a wife, you have plenty of passages in the Old Testament where women who are praying and are obedient to the Lord, their womb is open, right? The Lord himself opens their womb. A sign of blessing from God is a fruitful womb that is bearing many, many children. So you have some people who think this is kind of the end of relations between David and Michael. There are other people that believe this is a curse from God because of her disobedience. I think either way, the bottom line is that there are no kids, which means, as you just said, the house of Saul is now forever separated from Israel's eternal royal dynasty. So in a very real way, Saul's lineage dies in the barren womb of his daughter, who has no children with King David. And that is, as you said, there's going to be one other piece here that you guys will talk about, but in a very real way, this is the end forever of Saul and his household.
We got about 4 minutes here, Pastor Day, and I want to come back to something that we touched on but didn't talk too much about. You know, you mentioned David's dancing and the way that he worships here, and you know, we're Lutherans, we don't dance in church. but what, you know, what can we learn from David's approach before the Lord here? One of the things, at least I think about, is that, you know, when we worship, there is something to our outward posture, and we're used to, you know, bowing before the Lord. That's what the word worship often indicates in the scriptures. You literally bow down. So what can we take from David's approach to worshiping before the Lord from this text?
Yeah, somehow I knew we were going to come to this, right? Yeah, I mean, I joke and say that Lutherans don't dance. I will say, you know, I've been to Africa on more than a couple of occasions, and I've seen, you know, dancing in worship. And I just have to say that dancing is not what we would think of as dancing. I think in our culture and in the Western world, dancing itself, you know, like the Baptists, you know, you got to have room for the Holy Spirit in there, because there was a very sexualized view of dancing, which I don't think is seen in other parts of the world. And so when I'm not sure that the dancing that we're talking about here is the same when we think about dancing today,
right,
particularly just the sort of sexualization that tends to come to our mind. Now, the other thing, though, is just this true unrestrained worship and great joy and gladness that I think maybe we Lutherans do lack sometimes, and that there is a place for. When I was thinking about this, I just have one story that comes to mind. When I was in the parish in Houston, I had the opportunity to catechize a young man who had any number of developmental disabilities. And while there were a lot of things that you might think that Ricky didn't know or understand, Ricky deeply understood who Jesus was. And he particularly understood Jesus in the bread and in the wine. And this kid would become absolutely ecstatically overjoyed. Like when I would bring the communion kit, when Ricky would be going to the hospital to have surgery, I would bring the box because Jesus was like in the box, right? In the communion kit. And Ricky got extremely excited about this, like that we were going to be able to be with Jesus. And on the day of his confirmation, in fact, I remember him grabbing the hand of both Pastor Murray and I and like dragging us down the aisle during the procession. Ricky is just laughing and overjoyed. And when he came back from communion every single Sunday, he would almost skip and joy, and he would smile and wave at people in the congregation. And I oftentimes thought, that's good. I mean, yeah, maybe all of us should be like that. I mean, that there is an unrestrained joy and gladness in knowing who Jesus is and what he's doing for us. And so that's probably the best that I have on that. But
no, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. God grant us a faith and a joy like Ricky's when we are in the presence of the Lord Jesus Christ, receiving the gifts of his salvation, his
absolutely
holiness given for us. Absolutely. That's a fantastic image to leave us with this text. Pastor Bart Day serves as president and CEO of the Lutheran Church Extension Fund in St. Louis, Missouri. He's been helping us today to study 2 Samuel 6, verses 1 to 23. Pastor Day, thanks for being our guest today.
Hey, thank you for having me, Pastor Apple. Always a pleasure.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about 2 Samuel 6, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us tomorrow as we begin reading 2 Samuel 7, a very key chapter in the Scriptures in which the Lord makes a promise to David that he will have a descendant reigning on the throne forever. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk with you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.